There's an old saying that if you want to know where to put your money, look at where the rich people are investing. And so, you know, the fact that Bill Gates is now the largest farmland owner in the U.S., the fact that I've had several billionaires call me in the last year asking, how do I set up an agrarian bunker when things collapse, you know, so I'll be protected with my family. You know, those are little, what I call, you know, little flags that go off in your head, you know.
This is Kaiser Johnson with Liberty and Finance, and this is the Miles Franklin Weekly Special for January 31st through February 7th, 2023, while supplies last. This week we feature 2023 Austrian Silver Philharmonics at just $3.29 over spot per ounce. Frequently regarded as one of the most beautiful sovereign coins, the Austrian Philharmonic portrays instruments from the Vienna Orchestra on one side and the grand pipe organ from the famed Augsburg Golden Hall on the other, all in 3/9 fine pure silver with a face value of 1.5 euro. These 2023 Philharmonics come 20 to a tube, 500 to a box, are just $3.29 over spot, and are IRA eligible. And if you'd like to learn more about a precious metals IRA, call us and we'll be happy to help you in that process. Our number for all orders is 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237. We're available after hours and on weekends, and we look forward to speaking with you.
Welcome back to Liberty and Finance. We're privileged to have this distinguished and accomplished returning guest, Joel Salatin, a co-founder of Polyface Farms, is a widely followed author, lecturer, and teaching farmer from the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, where he and his family have educated numerous college students and also those learning how to do for themselves in terms of self-production of food, ensuring their food security. And he's joining us again this Thursday, February 2nd, 2023. Joel, thanks for coming back on Liberty and Finance.
Thank you, Don. Again, it's always a privilege to be with you.
This is our first time to do it via video. We've always used a phone connection before, and if it had rained the night before, the copper wires were wet and we couldn't get a good connection. So we've launched into the space age here, so let's hope that things hold together. And we wanted to talk again about the topic that we've interviewed with you a couple of times about, and that is how people can increase their food security. It's becoming a very pressing and present concern in people's minds across our country and across the world. There's been such events as farmers in certain countries not being able to get fertilizer. There's been supply chain breakdowns and geopolitical strife that have exacerbated that, with decisions being made by governments that make it difficult for their own people to produce food or for others in other countries. And now within the U.S., we've had a strange sequence of events where we had comments made by our president over the past couple of quarters saying there are going to be food shortages coming, it's going to get real. And then we had a rash of increased frequency of apparent disasters and mishaps and accidents and fires and crashes and boiler explosions and things at major food processing plants across the country. Most recently, there's been something that a lot of people have noticed, and that's the increase in egg prices and even scarcity of availability of eggs in their supermarkets and so on. And there's been reports, even as reported by Tucker Carlson on Fox News, of farmers all over the country saying that their hens have stopped laying, either drastically reduced output or none at all. And some of them have resolved that problem almost immediately by switching to local feed rather than big name commercial feed. Big questions around all of that, and leaves a lot of people scratching their heads and wondering, with as dependent as most people are on the supply chains or the grocery stores and that sort of thing for their food, what do we need to be aware of that's affecting our food supply, and what can we do about it as individuals?
Sure. Well, that was a big introduction there to unpack. So let's take it a little bit at a time. Let's start with the egg situation immediately. I think there are two completely different stories here, and it's easy for people to get them confused. So the story of the increased egg prices in the supermarket, the commercial farmers are not seeing the reduction in egg production. That is very much a backyard flock situation, a hobby farm backyard flock situation. That's not in commercial flocks. And most of those chickens, most of those non-laying backyard flocks, many of them are getting their feed from Tractor Supply Corporation, TSC, which has bagged chicken feed under the Purina label. That Purina bag is their feed. And right now the jury is out. Nobody really knows. And Purina's staying. They're not talking. Obviously it's a big deal. I've certainly heard, I heard it long before it was on Tucker Carlson. And so nobody's quite sure of that whole storyline, but that is very much a non-industry, non-commercial storyline. The second storyline is what's happening with highly pathogenic avian influenza, HPAI, which has now in the last year, I think, resulted in the destruction of 58 million chickens. The last time that this raised its head was in 2015, when we lost 44 million head of poultry. That's chickens, turkeys, and both broilers and egg layers, although it seems to affect egg layers first, and then turkeys, and then young chickens, meat chickens. That's kind of the echelon. So the eggs are definitely the most vulnerable. And according to the most recent statistics that I've been able to see here, we've lost roughly 6% of the laying hens in our country. Now, 6% doesn't sound very much, and there's already a suit. I don't know who's bringing it, but it's some consumer advocacy group that's already suing a couple big egg companies for price gouging. The chickens only went down 6%, and you're tripling the egg prices. You know, what's with that? Well, the thing that people don't realize, and your listeners are above average on understanding economics and finance, so it's going to be fun to unpack this for them. In things that are very stable and have a long shelf life, inventory has a lot of wiggle room. I mean, trust me, the inventory of, for example, copper in the world is pretty large right now. Steel, I mean, there's the things that are basic, stable commodities have long inventories. And so there's a lot of wiggle room there when you have a something like, you know, in this case, avian influenza, something that affects it. There's a pretty long thing. But when you come to food, and especially eggs, there are a few things as perishable as eggs. You know, you can't keep eggs for a year. You can't even keep eggs for 6 months. And so as you move down into highly perishable items, the margins become way, way thinner because the supply and demand have to be held way closer. In other words, you can have a half a year major hiccup in supply demand on large stockpile stable commodities. But when you go to highly perishable, unstable commodities, you can't have much difference between the supply and the demand. So imagine you have demand for 100 eggs, and you have chickens producing 100 eggs. I mean, that's the ideal world, right? We've got a perfect balance here between the demand and the supply. if you could maintain a buffer inventory of 130 eggs going into that 100 egg market, the inventory, the fluctuation in a crisis wouldn't have such a big effect. But when we say 6% here, so if you have 100 customers and you suddenly drop to 94 eggs, now suddenly there's a frenzy among those 100 to get those 94 eggs. What I'm suggesting is it has an inordinate magnified effect when you have really tight inventory, buy sell arrangements versus ones that where you can as a more stable inventory. And so that's why, you know, a 6%, a lot of these egg outfits are operating on 1% and 2% margins. Imagine that, 1% and 2% margins. And so a 6% change in the inventory suddenly is well, let's just say a 2% margin, a 6% change, six times is 12%. And in fact, then it magnifies because then, you know, the press picks it up, people get scared. Well, let's buy 3 dozen instead of 1 dozen. We're going to stock up in case there aren't any. And then that, you know, that just exacerbates. And of course, you know, that's what we had. That's what we had with lumber during COVID. That's why lumber, you know, spiked up through the roof and then dropped down because as lumber mills shut down with COVID, then that created a short-term price problem. Well, then construction people started trying to pre-buy lumber, and that just, you know, exacerbated. So these spikes, as you know, they tend to go above reason. And so let me just say something about that avian influenza thing. The thing that I want people to understand is that most of these 58 million head of poultry, and of course, we just had two more flocks here in the county adjoining us. I know they'll all be killed. So, I mean, that number of dead ones is going up. Realize if there's 100,000 chickens in a house and one bird tests positive for avian influenza, all 100,000, all 99,999 birds are killed. So when the industry, when you see the press reports, avian influenza has killed this many birds, it's not true at all. It's killed maybe we've killed 58 million, but avian influenza has actually only killed about 57 million. The rest of them were alive, many of them unsymptomatic. Many of them would have survived. I just actually talked to a guy in the last 2 weeks who had a flock of 3,000 birds, and they got avian influenza, and most of them died. All right, I don't want to minimize avian influenza. High path avian influenza is serious. I mean, if you're a chicken farmer, you don't want high path avian influenza. All right, so I don't want to be condescending about that or cavalier. It is serious. But here's my point. It killed most of the birds in that flock, but 250 of them, it never killed, and they were running around healthy as and laying eggs. They were doing great. Now, wouldn't you think that somebody would say, "Hey, what do those 250 birds have that the other 2,750 birds didn't? Maybe we ought to save those birds, breed them, save their offspring." And if we do that over a couple generations, maybe we can help nature adapt and build an immune system. And, you know, and that's the way nature adapts to things. The survivors survive, they breed, and you have adaptation. But no, in this case, one bird in 100,000, all of them are killed. And so when they say euthanized, that is absolutely the that is a perfect example of clever speak misrepresentation. They're not euthanizing means that an animal is sick, in pain, unrecoverable, and we put it out of its misery. No, the right word here is extermination. It's not euthanasia. There's nothing wrong with most of the birds. They're perfectly healthy. They're in fact exterminated, and so. I have a real problem, both philosophically and actually scientifically, with this notion that we're somehow going to get ahead of this if we kill all the survivors. You know, let's applaud the survivors. You know, and let's try to build a more resilient genetic line by hanging on to the survivors. I mean, that's what we do in genetics. Genetics, we You know, we take the survivors, we don't breed the weak, we don't breed the crooked, we don't bring the junk. We breed the good ones. And so the whole policy and protocol in this whole thing is just it's upside down. And there are the two stories. One is primarily a backyard story with something we don't know what's going on in the feed. Clearly it is a feed issue, but nobody's stepping up and saying, oh, you know, we messed up. Somebody pushed the wrong button for 6 months. You know, we don't know what that is. The other is very much an industry commercial situation that is being handled in an opposite protocol to what any thinking person would want to handle it.
We've certainly been subject to protocols that are debatably neither safe nor effective over the past 3 years in other areas of our lives. We can't get into details on that in certain venues and still stay a channel. But the question is this being driven top down? These protocols, are they being force fed from three-letter agencies that are telling farmers, you will do this or else?
Absolutely. I have no if we had a chicken here on our farm that tested positive for high path avian influenza, and Dunnigan, you have to realize that there is a tremendous amount of false positives and false negatives. These tests are extremely they're subjective. And I remember very well in 2015 when it came through our area, talking to farmers that would have a positive 1 week. Now it's negative next week. The tests are there is some subjectivity there, and so that makes you then put on your tinfoil hat and wonder about conspiracy. You know what's going on here. I don't want to go there in this. Let's just assume that it's real. And that there's not some, you know, nefarious agenda, but I will tell you that when this happens on a farm, the farmer has no recourse. It's not a warrant. It's not constitutional. The three-letter government agencies come in without a warrant, without anything. They have, they can come in and destroy everything you have. And the compensation is relatively minor. The compensation is especially if you're a specialty producer like us, the compensation is not nearly what the birds are actually worth.
You mentioned the word humanely euthanized earlier. In your understanding, the method, if you're going to slaughter 100,000 chickens or exterminate them, Are the methods that are routinely being used, in fact, humane?
Well, it's suffocation. What they do is they lock all the doors, close all the windows, and pump soap bubbles in. And as the soap bubbles build up in the house, they gradually suffocate all the chickens. Is that human? Well, I mean, what are the alternatives? I mean, you can't electrocute them. Nobody wants to go in and hand pick up all those 100,000 birds and then kill them by hand, you know, somehow. I think it's horrific. But that's the, you know, I can't think of a more efficacious way to do it. But it's horrendous. And then of course the beauty of the soap suds is, when the soap suds then dissipate, they just, you know, they just go down to nothing on the floor, and you got all these, you know, dead birds.
So you've discussed the avian flu, you've discussed the non-egg laying or reduced egg laying by certain backyard chickens that are eating certain commercial food. What about the other thing about this apparently increased rash of accidents, incidents, disasters at food processing plants all over the country? Do you have any statistics or information on that to say that this is actually an anomaly that's happening?
Yeah, I've certainly been well aware of that, and I've certainly watched the reports on it. And I don't know what to make of it, Dunnigan. I just don't know what to make of it. You know, there's a part of me that says, boy, that is. There are too many of them, and it's too odd to be random. I guess here would be my answer. My answer would be that if I said that this was some orchestrated nefarious agenda that somebody was orchestrating, you know, like the bad guy in a 007 movie, I would have to join the folks who believe that, you know, George W. Bush brought down the Twin Towers in New York. And, you know, that may be, I just can't go there. It's like too, maybe I just don't want to deal with it, but it's too much for me. And I can't do anything about it anyway. And so, so I equate those two kind of things. If you believe George W. Bush brought down the Twin Towers in New York, it's going to be very easy for you to believe that somebody is driving airplanes into chicken plants, you know. That'll be pretty easy. I don't know. I got enough on my plate right now that I don't have to sort that out yet. You know, I think it's safe to say that we had a cluster of these, yes, but is it continuing? I think that if it kind of stops and doesn't continue, I think we're in a different situation than if, yeah, I mean, if it happened over a period of 2 months and then all stopped and nothing else is going on, you know, it's still a stretch, but I think it's a plausible anomaly. But if we continue to see one, you know, one a month, every month, just continue one a month, that would be cause for alarm.
The other aspect of this we haven't talked about is twofold, and it is either being announced and predicted by world leaders, or it's being enforced by world leaders, and that's the denial of the ability of food to be shipped, or fertilizer to be shipped, or farmers to use fertilizer to feed their crop, their land, or their crops, or whatever their herds. And then there's the second, which is announced predictions by either the U.S. president or others saying food shortages are coming, starvation is coming, you know, buckle your seatbelts, we're going to have food shortages. This is not usual. These are not the kinds of things we normally have seen in the past. I'm asking you, this is actually a question. Have we seen this before, or is this truly anomalous?
This is truly new ground. We have not seen those kind of predictions, certainly in any time in modern history. And one of the things that we learned over the last 3 years, I think, for sure, if you're a thinking, reasonable person, one of the things that we learned was, you know, when these world leaders, when the World Economic Forum and that basic group of that fraternity, when they offer musings like this, they're not just blowing smoke. You can be assured that there's something there. And so, you know, when there were, you know, in 2019, when the World Economic Forum hosted basically role plays of what would we do in a pandemic, you know, everybody thought, well, that's silly. You know, what's that all about? Well, you know, within 6 months, then we had one. And I think that, so we learned when people like that muse about things. I'll tell you a personal story. It's really interesting. So about 12 years ago, I was asked to go speak in Sweden, and the trip was funded partially by an NGO and partly by the Royal Agriculture College there in Stockholm. And about a month before I was to go, the NGO guy, who was, you know, really the leader, emailed me in a panic, and he said, "A Royal Agriculture College just pulled out. You know, they're not going to fund you." And he said, "We might not be able to do it." I said, "Well, that's fine. You know, take a week to let the dust clear and see if you can get some more funding. And if you can't, then, you know, we'll cancel the trip. It's fine." And he called me in the week. He said, "Yeah, we got alternative sources. You know, come on." So I went on. So when I got there, I said, "So what happened? What, you know, what's the deal?" Somebody, you know, usually when you have a kind of an agreement arrangement like this, it comes on without a hiccup. And he said that that Monsanto went to the agriculture college and told them that if they would get rid of their 9 environmental sciences professors, Monsanto would fund the entire college. And so they got rid of the 9 environmental sciences professors, and and apparently took over the college. And as part of all of that, they saw that I was coming, and so we're going to defund him too. And so I asked the guy, I said, we're in Sweden. Monsanto's in the grain business. They, you know, they do herbicides and GMO grains and stuff. What's with them in Sweden? Sweden doesn't grow any grain. He said, ah, but you got to realize that these world leaders believe that with global warming, all of northern Scandinavia, Norway, Finland, Sweden, all that tundra is going to melt, and that's going to be the new breadbasket of the world, and that's going to be the new grain production area of the world. And it just as he was talking like this, it just struck me, oh, so that's what they really talk about in these summits. You know, you and I, Donnie, I don't know about you, but when I see these you know, heady summits and things, I always wonder what they're really saying. What's really being discussed, you know, behind those doors? And I felt like that little trip to Sweden that I did and talking with this fella, I got a personal glimpse into, you know, those kinds of discussions, those kinds of talks. And I don't know what got me all onto that, but well, you were just saying that when these world leaders, when these people start saying there's going to be shortage, people are going to starve, normally people like President Biden would say, hey, everybody, it's okay, man, we, you know, like Elizabeth Warren, I've got a plan, you know, I've got a plan. Normally they don't stand up there and scare people. Normally it's, we got this under control. I got my, you know, my food czar on it, and I've got my da da da, and we're all under control. And so I'm just saying that when these kinds of in the know people kind of let their guard down a little bit and muse about things, we need to realize that they're actually, you know, when Bill Gates says we really need to drop the world's population by a couple billion people, that's an important musing. That's you know, I mean, he funds, he's now pouring money into mRNA vaccine development for livestock, pouring money into that, and you know, there's an old saying that if you want to know where to put your money, look at where the rich people are investing. And so, you know, the fact that Bill Gates is now the largest farmland owner in the U.S., the fact that I've had several billionaires call me in the last year asking, how do I set up an agrarian bunker when things collapse, you know, so I'll be protected with my family. You know, those are little, what I call, you know, little flags that go off in your head, you know, that's happening. This is happening. This is happening. And you start seeing it. So when Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine and the world shut off and Russia supplies whatever, you know, over half the world's chemical fertilizers, because they've got all this petroleum. Chemical fertilizer is made from petroleum. And so Russia's petroleum base allows it to be the world's number one exporter of chemical fertilizers. And they have vast deposits of minerals and things like that as well that they can combine it with. So when that all happened and suddenly, you know, we shut down the ability to get fertilizer from Russia, you know, that threw everything into a tailspin. And I think Biden is looking at that, or these world leaders are looking at that. And I think they're looking at it in a long haul and questioning. Now, the beauty is that when all that happened last year, we're almost a year into this, aren't we? The Ukraine invasion. I think that was like February 24th last year or something like that. And I remember as soon as fertilizer spiked like 400%, I mean, it was just through the roof. And of course the farmers are whining on TV and, oh no, we're not, you know, how are we going to do? In our farm, it hasn't even been a blip because we don't buy any of it. And I think that's your fundamental message, and where we need to head for the listeners here on this podcast is how can you be as secure in the food system as we feel on our farm? We've created that security because we don't buy the chemical fertilizer. We buy, you know, we buy a tenth of the diesel and gas of the average farm per item of production. All those things. Yes. So we do buy some diesel and we do have some of that, but primarily we're a functional. And as far as the grain's concerned, we get all our grain for the chickens and cows. They don't eat grain, but the chickens, the omnivores, we get all that from, GMO free, Mennonite farmers here within, about, most of it is within 20 miles of us. And we know them, we know where their farms are, it's not like there's going to be some nefarious submarine intercepting the shipment of, the shipment of corn, from their farm to ours. We're all in the kind of the same region and we work together. And so the question I like to ask people is, go back to the spring of 2020 when store shelves went empty. Would we have had as big a hiccup in the system if instead of being supplied by 300, 5,000 employee mega processing facilities, if instead our nation had been supplied by 300,000 community scaled 50 employee, smaller processing facilities from canning to butchery to whatever. And the answer to that is pretty simple. Of course, we would have been able to weather it much better had our supply chains been more localized, more regionalized, and had we been serviced with a decentralized processing system rather than a centralized processing system.
Okay, so that leads me down to two questions that we need to hit before we wrap here. The first one is, how real is the concern? Is this a credible risk as far as consistency of food supply going forward for most Americans that they should be aware of? Is this just noise? Is this just hype? Is this just anomalies and blips and we can just coast through this, folks, don't worry? Or is this like, no, this is actually important and it's going to require action on individuals' parts? Number two will be, when we get to it, what can an ordinary person do? Yeah, both in their individual household and in their community. So let's start with the first question. Do you view this concern about a coming and worsening food shortage to be a credible, real and present concern that ordinary people should be paying attention to and taking action based on?
Yes, I do. And I'm not, again, I'm not a conspiratorial tinfoil hat. I'm just looking at the trend lines. I'm looking at trend lines and I'm also looking at Rome. At what happened to Rome? I mean, we are going down, and the whole civilizational cycle. Victor David Hansen, I think, is I've got the right guy. I just really appreciate his. He's like a wise. He's like a wise patriarch, isn't he?
Yep.
And he has this thing about civilizational cycles. That no civilization has ever exceeded 300 years. Normally they have their zenith and then they start to decline, and it's somewhere in the 230 to 270 year range, and that's consistent going all the way back to the Persians and Egyptians, and you go back these times. And so the U.S. is in that area, and goodness, the leadership ineptitude we have in our country right now. I don't know why anyone would have faith in Jean-Pierre. Why would anybody have faith in her or Blinken or any of these folks? And so I think there's an old Chinese saying that if you keep going the way you're going, you're going to end up where you're headed. And I think that, I think that we're in that. So what can a person do? There's a couple things. I mean, think about your own, your own vulnerabilities. So the first vulnerability is water. I mean, you can live a couple of weeks without food, but you can't live more than a couple of days without water. And so I'm a huge believer that everybody should install a cistern at their house. And I mean a cistern, not a 50-gallon jag of bottled water. I'm saying a cistern like half the size of a swimming pool where you can, you know, where you can have 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 gallons of water. So water's number one. Number two is to look into changing your flush toilet to a gray water return. So this is nothing more than than switching some plumbing. I mean, it's a little, and Dunnigan, I would love to see a resilience. I'm just brainstorming now, a resilience prep business where somebody would come in to your, cause a lot of people don't have plumbing skills or, you know, sounds daunting. It's intimidating. All right. But a plumber can very easily go in, reroute a couple pipes, send your shower water, your sink water, your clothes washer water, send it into a sump, you know, a 1,000-gallon tank that then is pumped up into your toilets. You can drop half of your water consumption by not having potable water through your toilet. I mean, that's huge. Okay. And all it takes is a little bit of piping. And then some of the most elegant systems I've ever seen about water, is a IBC tote up in the attic, and you just hook up a bicycle pump to your cistern, and in, you know, 10 minutes of bicycling a week, you can pump your water up. Now you can shut off your electric pressure tank, all your relays, all your electronics, and all your water runs by gravity. So I'm just talking about how do you not just survive like a caveman if things break down, but how do you flourish? How do you thrive even, you know, if things go down? So that's water. So water's number one. Number two then is going to be food. How are you going to feed yourself? And so I'm a huge believer in developing a larder. You know, people used to have a larder. And the average city right now, as you know, only has 3 days worth of food inventory in it, the average city. And that's why every time there's a snowstorm or anything else, you know, everything gets wiped out. So you should have, you should have several months worth of food. I mean, here we've got hundreds of quarts of home canned peaches and pears and applesauce and green beans and sauerkraut and all in the basement. When Teresa sends me to the store, I don't go to the store. She gives me her list, go to the basement, bring me up, you know, two jars of tomatoes, you know, one jar of green beans, you know, and I go to the basement. And so we didn't do this because we're preppers. We just did this. This is the way people lived, you know, because there weren't supermarkets long time ago. And so put in some lard and can, boy, let me, while I'm on that, canned meat. There's nothing as nutrient dense as canned meat. It's already cooked. And if everything goes to pot, it's already cooked. You don't even have to cook it. You can eat cold meat if you need to, but it's very, very nutrient dense. A canned meat packs a lot of punch in a jar. So, get a half a beef or get some extra and can. And if you have 50, 60 quarts of canned beef and pork and chicken sitting on the shelf, the refrigeration can go down, water can go down, all sorts of, but you've got a really nutrient dense food. I mean, this is why the Native Americans lived on, you know, on pemmican. I mean, this was a very nutrient dense created pemmican and jerky. And I mean, you know, when they traveled, and they would travel long distances, you know, by foot. And then when the horses came from the conquistadors, they got horses. But when they traveled long, they could travel for days, weeks on a trail, just toting jerky and pemmican and eating, you know, 4 or 5 ounces of that a day. And it was perfectly fine. They didn't carry cucumbers and watermelons and squash. They carried extremely nutrient dense things. And of course, this is the background of cheese. This is where cheese came from, was a way to store, to stabilize milk prior to refrigeration. So the point is that if you've got, you know, if you've got 50 quarts of canned beef and pork and chicken on the shelf, you know, you can weather something pretty far. And don't get Lunchables and Hot Pockets. That's not acceptable stored food. You want actual authentic food. You want it from a farm like us. All right. So, you know, do a little bit of sleuthing and find your source. The next thing, of course, you need shelter. And so how vulnerable is your house? You know, is it pretty stable, or are you, I mean, there's an understanding in a lot of people that if things go down, you don't want to be stuck in a city. And that's what's fueling the homestead tsunami right now. There are hundreds of thousands of people that are fleeing urban areas, getting small acreages in the country. So, you know, you've got your water, you've got your food, you've got your shelter. The shelter is, you know, how vulnerable is your home? And, you know, can you get heat? Can you get firewood? Maybe a backup wood stove if you need, or something to where you keep yourself heated if necessary. And I'd say the final thing is skill. Learn a real practical skill, how to fix, you know, whatever, plumbing, welding, you know, instead of watching Netflix, go to some vocational class and learn some, a skill, woodworking or, anything like that, where that's barterable, that's practical and barterable, you know, in a community. Those are things that I think are going to stand us in good stead going forward.
Joel, there's a lot more that we need to unpack on this topic of food security and preparedness. You've been a great ally with us through the years on these topics, and there's so much that you've done both personally and know people who have done these things, that you've got a wealth of practical knowledge around those topics. So we're going to need to circle back with you on those. It seems like it's going to be something that people do have to pay close attention to and take action on in the quarters to come. So starting now, and we'd like to have you back. We got some technical difficulties today that have made a little bit of challenges with the video feed, but we'll overcome those as we need to. And just always grateful for your presence on Liberty and Finance. And could you tell people where they can find out more about the educational opportunities and the other resources that are available through Polyface Farms?
Sure. We have a very comprehensive website. It's Polyface Farms, P-O-L-Y-F-A-C-E, polyfacefarms.com. And there's everything there, from the classes we do, my speaking engagements, all the books that I've written, those kinds of things. There's a lot of stuff there. So Polyface Farms, and you can buy food from us as well. So polyfacefarms.com, be glad to see you there.
We've been speaking with Joel Salatin, author, lecturer, and farmer. And Joel, as always, thanks for joining us on Liberty and Finance.
Thank you for having me.
Miles Franklin Precious Metals is one of America's oldest and most trusted bullion dealers. Miles Franklin is A+ rated and accredited by the Better Business Bureau, licensed and bonded, and has zero complaints ever registered. Here at Liberty and Finance, we are licensed brokers with Miles Franklin. To order, simply call us, discuss your needs, and we can let you know our live inventory, prices, and availability, and lock in your order over the phone. Once your order is locked, the price is held for you regardless of market fluctuations, and the metals are reserved for you awaiting your settled payment. Within one business day of ordering, you will receive an email invoice detailing the order and payment instructions. Miles Franklin accepts payments by bank wire, ACH or electronic check, money order, check mailed priority mail, and cryptocurrency. The fastest forms of payment are bank wire and cryptocurrency. Upon settled payment, metals will ship out within 3 to 5 business days. You will receive tracking information via email. Domestic shipping charges are $15 for any order under 500 ounces of silver or 10 ounces of gold. For orders larger than that, domestic shipping is free. The package will be boxed, fully insured, and labeled discreetly, with no indication of the contents inside. For your privacy, the name Miles Franklin will not even be on the package. To talk to myself, Kaiser, my brother Elijah, or my father, Dunnigan, call 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237.